I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Pentagon has confirmed that the recent explosion at the mess hall in Mosul was most likely the work of a suicide bomber. Underlining once again, as if the fact needs underlining, that there is nothing conventional about the conflict that is drawing some 150,000 American soldiers into Iraq for the next few weeks and months. Colin Powell said this week that U.S. soldiers will likely have to stay in Iraq in significant numbers for much of the next year. Well, in the short term, there are questions about the viability of an Iraqi election. In the longer term, more questions about the viability of those Iraqi fighting forces. And all the time, there's the question, how does the military, can the military, win a war against insurgents and suicide bombers? Today, we'll be talking with soldiers and also with family members who've lost loved ones. We'd like to hear from you on the program as well. Do you think that the U.S. has an obligation to stay in Iraq until there is some semblance of stability, order in that country? Are you among those who's thinking it's time to shut it down? Bring the soldiers home. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today from a studio in Portland, Oregon, we have Eric Blickenstaff. Eric's brother, Joseph Michael, was killed a little over a year ago. Eric was with us earlier this fall talking about his family, his experience, and he's going to be with us on the program as well. Eric, it's nice to have you back with us.
Yes, thanks for having me back.
And here with me in the Connection studio in Boston, Army 2nd Lieutenant Jim Meeks. He served in Iraq last year. He was injured there. He came home. He has finished his latest training, and he leaves for Iraq again next month. It's nice to have you back here as well, Jim.
Thank you for having me here.
How are you doing? How's the arm?
It's doing a lot better than it was, and pretty much 100% recovery.
Does that mean you can forget about it now, or are you always going to have to worry about the shrapnel? Because you've got this sort of mottle of scars up the inside of your arm where you were injured.
Well, I was talking to an old vet from Vietnam who had a similar injury from a mortar attack, and he told me it's the gift that kept on giving, and that for years it might come up with certain infections because the shrapnel doesn't necessarily work its way out of your body, so you just have to kind of get used to it and catch it when you can. But other than that, I've got full range of motion, and the power in my hand is back, so I'm deployable, and that's what counts, I guess.
Well, you've been in Kansas for the last little while. What were you doing there? What were you working on?
Well, when I got back to Kansas from Iraq, from convalescing here in Boston, I was switched to another unit, 234 Armor, and then I took over platoon. We've been training both with our tanks and conventional gunnery and how to maneuver the tank, and then also dismounted tactics, which tankers aren't necessarily normally known for, but it's obviously what our mission is Iraq. And so we're trying to catch up on our tactics and our doctrine in order to handle this mission and how it's unique from the other things that we're traditionally trained for.
Okay, help me with some of the language here. Dismount tactics, what does that mean?
Okay, well, in the Army, you have two types of soldiers, mounted and dismounted, and the mounted are the ones who are in a tank, and we have a saying, we used to have a saying that was death before dismount, and you never left your tank no matter what. And so we're not used to hopping off and running on the ground to talk with the townspeople or deal with insurgents who are running on feet. The dismounted, which is kind of the infantry, what my friend Seth Moulton is trained to do is to actually interact with the population, to maneuver on foot. It's very difficult to change a culture of not wanting to dismount as a tanker and being wedded to your tank to realizing that the greatest asset or the most important part of us being there is actually how we interact with the Iraqi people, not how we have a presence.
So is there kind of a contradiction in taking a tank into Iraq now? I mean, if you think of the sort of conventional use of a tank in warfare, it's tank against tank, it's attacking something. None of that, well, not much of that is in most people's imagination left to do, is it?
No, I would say none of it is. Yeah, the purpose of a tank is to kill another tank, and that's what our mission is. But at the same time, everything in the Army is built in with redundancy, and you have to be able to be cross-trained. And the tank has other purposes. It's a good security force. It has incredible psychological implications. If you set up a tank at a checkpoint, I think people are more likely
to slow down?
Less inclined to give you any trouble. So you can use the tank in certain strategic ways. We also will have Humvees for the areas in which it's more difficult to maneuver a tank. But at any point, any technology, you have to be able to use in multiple different ways. And we're finding totally new ways about what the capacity for our tanks are and how we can use them in this fight.
You were in Iraq, almost a year ago, March of 2003, is that right?
Yeah.
When you went in?
Yes.
I mean, even at, well, I guess particularly at that time, nobody knew what you were going in to see. Nobody had any idea what Iraq was going to become. And I'm wondering if you look back at that time and think, boy, when I went in March of 2003, it was, hey, this is what we're trained to do. Let's go. This may be a very interesting. Tell me what was in your mind back then, because my next question is going to be, so how do you look at it this time around when you know so much more about what the quality of your mission is going to be?
Well, the American Army, as we have it, is designed to defeat the Soviet Union in Europe. And it's adapted a little bit from that, but not much. And that's how we've trained. And the tactics that I learned in my officer basic course were pretty much these maneuver warfares, as if we were going to be fighting the communist bloc. This is obviously has nothing to do with what we're used to, but it's not something that the Army hasn't done before. And it's not something that similar armies, like especially Great Britain, haven't experienced. And so what really happens is, within a democratic army, you're always training initiative and creativity, and that's what's being tested right now, is how creative can commanders get in taking the principles of war, the very basic doctrinal facts, which are universal and I think apply in almost any conflict.
Talk to me a little bit, though, about what's in your head. I mean, I can't help but think that in March of 2003, there probably wasn't a higher level of excitement, interest, enthusiasm among you and your fellow soldiers.
Yeah, I mean, we were ready for the challenge, and we were excited about it. I think we had no idea how difficult it would be and how much we would have to adapt our own training and our own understanding about how we functioned to a new environment. And now going back and thinking about my experience in Iraq and, you know, talking with some of my friends who were over there, is figuring out, we're always changing ideas. Hey, did this work? Did that work? No, this is no good. Try this. And so constantly, it's a pretty exciting environment because we're on the edge of something that's very new, and we're just racing to figure out how best to attack it.
But are there people in your platoon, people you're commanding, who are coming up to you and saying, Lieutenant, I saw the news from Mosul yesterday. This is starting to look pretty creepy.
I don't know. I think they're a little, they wouldn't want to get caught saying that, but I'm sure they're thinking it. And
Are you?
I saw that it was creepy the first day I got down on the ground, and I can't deny that it's very frightening, and it's frightening in a way that I think a conventional war wouldn't necessarily be, because you're looking at every individual person, every individual Iraqi, wondering, is this person my friend or is he going to try to kill me? And when things happen like that in Mosul and how random it is, and that there was, it seems to me tactically or strategically, not much we could have done in defense against this, it does. It gives you a feeling of vulnerability that we're not used to.
Let's hear from Eric Blickenstaff for a couple of moments here. Eric, your brother Joseph Michael was killed, I guess, just a little over a year ago now. Is that right?
Yes, we honored the anniversary of his death on December 8th up in Tacoma, Washington.
And if I recall our last conversation about this time last year, you were still trying to figure out what had happened to Joe. It was hard to get that information that he had drowned in a canal when his Stryker vehicle had rolled in.
Yes, we had gotten one military report, and actually just 2 weeks ago we found out there are two more reports that have never been offered to us. But his unit's back from Iraq now, and the people who were there have given us some of the best information.
More than just information, what else did they bring back? Were they able to bring back some sense of Joe, of comfort for you or for the family?
Yes, several of the guys who were with him the last days of his life, once they got to Iraq, have talked about the spirit and how he was adjusting to being in Iraq. But they've also brought back a lot of pain about that accident and his death, the other deaths, and then just being in Iraq and their mission there.
How are you doing?
Oh, it's tough for me. This is a hard week. I just returned from speaking about the war in Japan, and the news has been just absolutely horrible the last few days.
You mean the suicide bomber, or more than that?
Oh, more than that. The suicide bombing, the Star Wars missile program and missing, the elections, President Bush's so-called reform of the intelligence, blaming his thoughts of WMDs on the intelligence, and just very depressing all the way around.
You've been busy since we last spoke. It sounds like you've become, in a way, more motivated to be speaking out against this war. Am I right about that?
You're very right. You know, our mainstream media deletes a lot of the truth about Iraq, and the more I learn, the more motivated I get to get the word out, such as over 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq and estimates of over 100,000 U.S. soldiers who will have PTSD or depression, many of them needed to be treated for the next 30 years. So these are very significant statistics that most of America is not aware of, and I think every American should be very concerned about.
Now, do you work on this for your own sake, Eric, or do you do it more for your brother Joe?
You know, it started out doing it for my brother Joe, and that will always be a motivation, but I do it for his friends, my other friends who are soldiers I know personally. And I physically, myself, see them suffering emotionally from the things they've been ordered to do in Iraq and the constant worry for their own lives. And, you know, we've had over 1,300 U.S. casualties, which is horrible. But compare that to 100,000 civilians in Iraq that are not being talked about. And then their emotional state of the majority of the population that is not the Islamic extremists, you know, is not being talked about.
We also talked when you were with us last time in September about the sort of a divisiveness within your family, that there were people who, and I don't know how far you want to go into this, but debates within the family about what was the best way to honor Joe. Was it to become outspoken against the war? Was it to continue to fight? Is that still going on?
Not as much. Since we talked last, my sister has joined the group I'm part of, Military Families Speak Out. My other sister, while living in Idaho, 80% Republican state, has spoken out a lot against the war, very brave. My mother is agreeing with, you know, this opinion as well. There are still a few, but, yeah, I think as more people get more information, and true of the country as well, this view will be more prominent.
And you've got a stepbrother who's going back into Iraq, who's in uniform, right?
He was in Iraq last time we talked. He's home now, but yes, he just got word he'll be sent back to Iraq for the third time.
What's he think about that?
You know, I'll get to see him on the 26th and hear myself, but, you know, I guess I won't speak for him, also for fear of him being punished.
You think that's a possibility or a likelihood?
That he would be punished, I think, is a very likelihood. Any soldier who's still in the military has that to face, and I will always respect that.
Jim Meeks, we're coming up to a break, but just before we do that, is that an understanding among you and other soldiers that there are limits to what you can say in terms of criticizing either the war or that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't think it's our role. I mean, we have kind of a civic community and politicians who get to debate that. We take our orders and we have to execute on it. And we have our own internal debates about how we're going to do that best. But whether we should be or not, it's beyond us.
Although it is not beyond what we see every day in the newspaper, with news coming out of Iraq showing that it is ever more dangerous place. There are more U.S. soldiers going into Iraq in anticipation of the elections at the end of the month. What are your thoughts about it? Are you among those who are beginning to think that the whole venture is something of a bad idea, or is this the time to sort of dig in and support under any circumstances? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about the war in Iraq with people who are on their way back in there, people who are there, people who are raising questions about the worth of the entire venture. We'd like to have you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to know what your thoughts are, because certainly there's lots of news coming out of there and people are talking a lot about it. Many people changing their minds, other people determined not to. 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go, if we can now, to Iraq. We are joined on a satellite telephone line by 1st Marine Lieutenant Seth Moulton. He is based in Najaf, leading the 3rd Platoon C Company there with the 11th Expeditionary Force. It is his second tour of duty in Iraq, and he's posted in the Shiite holy city of Najaf in the south of Iraq, where he is working to train Iraqi soldiers. Seth was with us on a recent program, and Seth, it's good to have you back again.
Hi, thanks very much, Dick.
Now, you and... Sorry, you and Jim are classmates. You were in the same year at Harvard. I don't suppose you often get a chance to talk to each other, so I can back away a little bit and let you guys catch up.
Lieutenant Moulton,
you keeping your head down over there?
I'm
doing pretty well, thanks. It's good to hear you, Jim.
Is everything quiet over there?
Everything in Najaf is really going quite well. We had a car bomb a few days ago, but the Iraqis took care of it themselves, and we haven't had any problems since. So we've been pretty lucky here in Najaf for the past couple months.
Time to come home, man.
Yeah, we've got a little time to go. We'll be at least through the elections, and we'll see how all that goes, and then look towards coming home.
Seth, I'm wondering what the news of the suicide bomber in Mosul, how that was received by you and other Marines in Najaf. Did that cause people to stop and talk about it?
To be perfectly honest, Jake, no. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, and it certainly hits home because we are obviously in very similar circumstances. I mean, the chow hall looks identical from the pictures we see. But to be perfectly honest, we're used to death as a course of life over here, and we understand that, you know, Americans die more or less every day or every week, and so we really just carry on with our jobs, and it really doesn't get us down.
So are you telling me then that the news is sort of routinely bad, so this one didn't register that well? Because that's another way of hearing what you're saying to me, if I understand it correctly.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's just routinely bad. I mean, certainly the news from Najaf itself has been routinely good for a while.
Right.
But obviously throughout Iraq, I mean, bad things happen on a fairly daily basis. And that's not to say that there aren't an awful lot of good things going on as well, but you do get accustomed to hearing the bad reports and understanding that there are Americans dying still.
I want to just hear for a couple of moments from Eric Blickenstaff in Portland, Oregon. I mean, you are probably much of the same age as Seth and Jim, who are talking as soldiers in uniform there. And where do you come down on that great American puzzle parlor game of the last 2 years, where it's, you know, I don't support the war, but I do support the troops, when you're actually listening in on this kind of conversation?
Well, I come down that exactly. I definitely support the troops, and I want them to have good lives when they get back. I hear, you know, the last person just talk about the news is routinely down and not really affecting them. But the facts are that when they get home, it does affect them. Some estimates 25% of them, and the VAs are already full. 9 of 10 of them are turning Vietnam vets away. So we're not ready to help them when they get back, and that's one of my and my group's efforts is to support them and get them home alive and take care of them.
Are you talking about physical injuries, or are you talking about stress injuries?
Well, I was just talking about stress injuries, and then, of course, physical injuries too. But the VAs, the mental health issues, 9 of 10 people are being turned away right now. This is not good.
I wonder if this gets is sort of thing that's talked about Jim Meeks with among soldiers, and sort of like what kind of support structure is there for us here in America?
I don't think soldiers really have a vocabulary for this kind of thing. We're used to you try to train a soldier to be comfortable with killing and taking orders. You don't know how to train him to be comfortable with the moral effects of that. And I think we're all struggling with that, and we're all struggling to find a vocabulary for it. And Eric, I really have to thank you for what you're doing, because you truly are supporting your troops in ways that I know a lot of us need it. And I have seen a lot of these people coming back with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I think there's going to be a point in which the Army's going to have to count that as a casualty as much as someone coming back with a missing arm.
I definitely agree, Jim, and thank you for that. And we've had members who have had their sons commit suicide because of these emotional stresses. And you're right, that's not counted as a casualty of Iraq when it should. And I just want to take a minute, too, to tell both of you how much I respect you and honor you and, do not hold you accountable for these things happening.
You want to jump in here, Seth? You're the person who's actually sitting in country right now.
Right. Well, I mean, they're both right. I mean, psychological casualties are absolutely a part of every war, and this one is no exception. I had some Marines who, showed some visible signs of of trouble, especially after we were involved in the heavy fighting here in August. And a lot of times the solution to that, as best we can see, is just to talk about it. But talking about it, like Jim says, is not always an easy thing to do. I mean, Marines are so taught to be rough and tough and not really share their feelings. So it takes some effort by commanders and leaders to really understand the problem and try to deal with it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, an opportunity for all of us to sort of weigh in on the obligations that the United States has in Iraq, questions that are being raised in this country about whether or not the venture, lasting as it might, another year or two or three, is worth the cost in unrest in that country and lives and injuries of Americans who are serving there. Let's go to Lexington, South Carolina, for our first call. Lynn's joining us from there. Hi, Lynn.
Thank you. Hello.
I'm glad you called. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm an Army wife, and my husband's been active duty Army for more than 10 years. And while he's not in Iraq yet, I certainly expect him to be deployed. And it makes me just sick that it's such a lie that this war is just a quagmire, and we were lied into it by a president who's being apparently controlled by a group of neocons who, if Americans really want to support our troops, they'll educate themselves about what this foreign policy is really all about, a plan for a new American century, PNAC. I wish everybody would Google that and find out that this isn't going to stop. If we pull out of Iraq, there's just going to be more wars, because that's what these chicken hawks and the administration want to do.
What do you make of public opinion polls that show a growing number of people in this country, Lynn, having questions about the motivation, the reason for staying in Iraq?
I'm surprised that anybody could have supported the war in the first place, but then when I look at the things that come out of the media, I can't call it anything but propaganda, and I don't know if they're operating on fear out of being obedient to what the administration wants, but I just don't see a lot of truth coming out of the media, and I don't see reports on casualties. I don't see pictures of our wounded soldiers or the dead civilians, and I think there's a reason for all of it, and it scares me to death.
Lynn, I want to thank you for being with us, and I'm going straight across to Fayetteville, North Carolina, where John's joining us. John, are you there?
Mr. Gordon, I'm here.
Thanks for calling.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
What are you thinking?
I'm an Army Reservist, sir. I'm finishing a year of mobilization. I've got a family and three kids. I served in Iraq. I was in the first fight in Fallujah. I'm wholehearted behind staying the course, continuing the mission, and setting the conditions for the Iraqis to have stability and security. I've got a brother that's on active duty. He's ramping up for his second tour in Iraq. It's close and personal for me.
Hey, John, how are you so sure it's going to work? I mean, I hear that in your voice, and I'm just wondering where you get that determination that this is the right thing to do. John, are you there?
Americans, yeah, I'm there.
Go ahead.
This war is going to be determined in American living rooms. Whatever we decide that we're willing to do, we're capable of. I met enough Iraqis of goodwill to know that they've got the wherewithal to be a secure nation. They need help. We're able to give it to them, and they deserve it.
We hear from a lot of Iraqis that Americans should leave the country, and Seth Moulton, you're working with a number there who have chosen to serve with the Americans there. When you listen to John, would you say that on balance, the people that you are working with, the people that you know, would agree with that?
I think they will. I think that the war will really be won here on the ground with the Iraqis, not in American living rooms. But most of the Iraqis that I work with on a daily basis, especially with the Iraqi National Guard, are pretty optimistic, and they understand that there's a lot of tough work ahead, and it will take some time. But they definitely want to see this thing through.
Let's just keep it in the American living room, though, for the time being, Jim Meeks, because you will be for the next few days until you're sent to Iraq. You listen to those two diametrically opposed views expressed, I think, quite clearly by John and Lynn. How is the country supposed to reconcile that, or does it matter if it doesn't?
I think one of the problems is that people get into a historical debate before the event at hand is concluded. And so if you want to decide whether we should have gone into Iraq or not, we won't really have evidence for that for a long time. But what you do have are the facts at hand, and as I see it, is we cannot lose. And as far as what Lieutenant Moulton has been seen in Najaf with al-Sadr trying to take over an otherwise peaceful city. What I saw when I was a prison warden and some of these people that we're going up against. If America is to pull out now, the people with the guns are the people who will win. And the people with guns are acting in ways that no civilized country can hope or wish that on another people. And there's a saying in the Army that if you break it, you buy it. We broke it, and we're going to be as good stewards as we can. And I think we cannot fail the Iraqi people. We've made the obligation to them. And I hope that no matter what our reservations are about whether we should have been in or not, or how it's being conducted, which I think are legitimate debates, we can't forget that democracy is the best chance for what I think is the majority of the Iraqi people. And the alternative is something that is incredibly grim.
Eric, talk to me about your thoughts of the end game, that the way that Jim's describing it here, that, you know, yes, in fact, there are many, many reasons to say that the whole venture is flawed all the way along, but that when you look at the point of it all, that you can't say, no, it's wrong.
I agree that we're there now, and we should focus on what's happening now. Having just talked to three people who represent large groups in Iraq, people who live in Iraq, the majority of the population in Iraq is not being represented now by the interim government or the Islam extremists. They think America should leave now, but they know they need help, but they think it should be another Islamic country. And I would offer that it's right. We broke it. We need to fix it. But the way of fixing it would be to withdraw and support as we're asked to, rather than decide what's best for a different country.
These Iraqis you're talking about, these are people you met on your recent trip into Japan?
Yes, one of them represents the Organization of Women's Freedoms in Iraq. One of them represents the Unemployed Union of Iraq, which is the largest, 150,000 people. That's the largest organized group of anywhere in Iraq other than what the interim government would offer or the Islam extremists. I believe from talking with them that they are more of the general opinion of Iraq.
Let's take a call from Bedford, Massachusetts. Bill's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thank you for doing the show.
Mm-hmm. Nice to have you here. What are you thinking?
I'm agreeing with the last comment. I don't know if that was Jim or Eric, about that we do have a responsibility in the sense that we've, in a large part, created the problem that we went in. You know, obviously, we've gone over the reasons for going in are not held to be true, but there is a problem now. I do agree that we need a third party. My analogy, as hard as it would be to hear this, is that there is some truth to abuser creating a problem and then insisting on staying. So I think the abuse is not so much the soldiers because they've been forced to be there, but I think when the civilian population, the leaders here, have said we needed to go to war because of nuclear threat or whatnot, then we are, we've been committed to fight a war we didn't need to be fighting. So I do agree we need a third party to help reconcile, but we need to get out.
Seth Moulton in Najaf, what would happen if the order came down, tent pegs up sometime in the next 6 weeks, this isn't working? Have you any idea?
I think that in a few places, like in Najaf, things would go pretty well because the local security forces are in pretty good shape. But we actually handed over local control officially to the Iraqis a few weeks ago. But I think that there's no question that in many parts of the country, it would really descend into chaos. And I can't agree more with Jim that, you know, until we can create a more stable Iraqi government and Iraqi armed forces and security forces, that we really do need to stay the course here. And we owe it to ourselves and to the Iraqi people and perhaps the entire Middle East.
What about Bill's point, though, Jim, that the American soldier may have reached a point where the Iraqis don't want to take direction or assistance or any kind of help? And the idea being that, yes, it might be chaos in the short term, but right now, America's more of a problem than it is part of the solution.
I find that a little bit difficult to believe because it seems to me what I'm reading is there is a civil war that is simmering beneath the surface, and Americans are the proxy for groups that are going to fight, just like Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists fought to take control over Iraq. And the people who I think would win are not the people that are in our self-interest. But the phrase that my battalion commander used and that I trust him and believe in is that we are going there to train ourselves out of a job. And so that our obligation is to prepare the Iraqi National Guard so that we don't have anything left to do. I believe, and I can't ask for the public to believe, but I trust the military and my command structure to assess the situation and give the recommendation to the president saying, okay, these people are ready to govern the streets, because it is the military commanders who have the kind of the intelligence and the most sophisticated analysis of what the enemy is capable of doing. And the enemy is not just an enemy of America, but it's an enemy of democracy in Iraq. And so I think when we will get out as quickly as possible, it's not like the military wants to stay, and I don't think the administration wants to stay, but we will stay until it's ready to withdraw prematurely, I believe, as far as what I understand about the security situation there, is dangerous. And whether people want us there or not doesn't necessarily reflect whether it is safest for them.
Eric, I'm just wondering what Jim has just expressed. That I don't suppose is really ever heard by Iraqis in terms of getting it from the soldier instead of hearing it from a politician and being very suspicious of it.
Yes. The Iraqis I talked with were very happy to hear that there were American soldiers who want to be out, American soldiers going to jail rather than going back. So I don't think the average Iraqi really knows that the soldiers do have good intent and want to be out. And if I may just mention that they said one of the biggest problems is that the interim government is Ba'athist itself. And they don't want to trade one Ba'athist government for another.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number. Join our conversation this hour as we take a look at the war in Iraq. We are now just a matter of weeks away from an election. There is a tremendous amount of pressure on American soldiers who are there to try and make sure that this election works properly, and an equal amount of pressure on the administration for taking too many American soldiers too close to harm's way for something that is so difficult to predict. What are your thoughts about the place of the soldiers in Iraq today? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Marine Lieutenant Seth Moulton is joining us live on a satellite line from Najaf, Iraq, where he is training Iraqi soldiers. His former classmate and colleague, Jim Meeks, is here with me in the studio. Jim will be returning to Iraq as a tank commander sometime in the next couple of weeks. Eric Blickenstaff is joining us from a studio in Portland, Oregon. His brother, Joseph Blickenstaff, was killed in Iraq just a little bit over a year ago. And in recent weeks, Eric has found himself becoming increasingly active and outspoken in terms of criticism of this war. We'd like to hear what your thoughts are, whether or not you're changing your mind, whether or not that's a difficult thing to do, having taken one position on the war perhaps some months ago. Is it particularly difficult to reevaluate that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our next call from Jacksonville, North Carolina, and Jason's with us. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
I just had a couple of comments about the whole war situation that we have going on. I'm a staff sergeant with the Marine Corps here in Jacksonville. I just recently got back from Mosul, Iraq, last October. And, I mean, the only way that the war is ever really going to be won, or the conflict that's going on over there, is to go house to house and help the people out. Yeah, we're doing the right thing because the people did need help and the regime did need to be changed. But as far as wrapping up everything that's going on over there, what we're really going to need to do is just go, and I hate to say it, is house to house and help each individual out, which is basically impossible, as I know.
Sergeant, let me ask you something about what has changed, though, in the time that you were in Mosul and today. I mean, it is far enough into the north of the country and far enough away from the Sunni triangle so as not to necessarily be thought of as much of a front-line city. But the latest news from Mosul is that there is a curfew in place, that the five bridges into the city are all shut down. And I can only imagine that that is going to create as much ill will as it is going to try and create a sense of security. The point is, does that mean things are getting worse?
Well, possibly. I mean, things are only going to get worse until they get better. I mean, that'd be like shutting down every major inlet into New York City and then saying, well, every other day we're going to open up and let people out. Mm-hmm. It's for your own protection. Well, yes, it is, but then you're still going to have the resentment of the people that live there. When I was there, my little brother was with me. He's with the Army, and I was with the Marine Corps, and it just so happened that we are deployed to the same area at the same time. And, I mean, the people seemed to want us there. I was with a helicopter unit. He was with a tank unit. And I just want to say thank you to the lieutenant that's over there doing his job right now. And he was doing the exactly opposite thing we were doing. We were doing aerial assault, and he was doing basically security. And we were getting the same reaction from both sides of the Iraqi people. They wanted us there, or it seemed like they did anyway.
What's the level of suspicion, Seth, that you see now, not from the people that you're working with, not from the people who are being paid as soldier and guard trainees, but just civilians in Najaf? Are they keeping their distance from you?
I have to be perfectly honest that they're not. I mean, the people here are really very supportive of us, largely because we got rid of the militia that was really terrorizing their lives for much of the summer here. And the item or the issue on the forefront of every Iraqi's mind is, of course, security. And their primary concern is having safe neighborhoods, safe cities in which to live. And if the Americans are bringing them security and making their security better, then they're very happy with us. And obviously, long-term, they don't want to have to be occupied, have us here. But in the short term, they just want a solution to their security problems. And whether that comes from Americans or Iraqi National Guard or Iraqi police, whoever's able to bring that, they're generally supportive of.
And Jim Meeks is an Army second lieutenant who is now trained to command a tank battalion. You're going to go over there with your soldiers and say, today we're playing soccer with the Iraqi kid or something like that, are you not?
Hope so. I hope I have that opportunity. Maybe we can spend the whole year playing soccer.
I just wonder whether or not the kind of, you know, it's not a little bit bizarre to be trained to do one thing and find yourself doing something that really wasn't part of the original book.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why you're going to see so many kind of hiccups and errors and mistakes that are going on is because we're not trained for this and we don't really know necessarily how to handle it. But also, I don't think you could train for this, even if, you know, this has been our doctrine for 100 years, to win over a population and also punish the insurgency. I mean, when Mao talked about the kind of insurgency he wanted to fight in China, he said, you have to swim with the fish. And so if the insurgency can entwine itself with the population, how do you separate the bad from the good and how do you reward the good and punish the bad?
Well, surely to goodness, that's how somebody gets inside a mess tent with explosives strapped to their body.
And how can you avoid that when you're trying to establish trust? And we're trying to create trust with the people. We're trying to show our goodwill. And if that trust is violated, then we respond. And some might say that we over-respond. And trust takes years to establish, and it takes a day or 1 hour in order to destroy. And that's not just a problem with the Army. It's not a problem with war. It's a problem with the human condition. And you're just seeing it played out on this huge scale with 135,000 individuals who are trying their hardest to show that they have goodwill.
Let's take a call from Moline, Illinois, and Jack's calling from there. Hi, Jack. Thanks for calling.
Well, good morning.
Tell me what you're thinking.
I'm thinking that, you know, I'm listening to your guest speak. And what I'd like to address is, you know, you guys are talking about what our soldiers are doing in Iraq, what the Iraq interim government is doing as far as trying to bring stability and peace to Iraq. But what I'm thinking is that I've heard this idea from many other people, many other speakers about Iraq, how the Iraqi government is going to bring peace and stability to there. But what I see is that there is a plan to have a permanent American presence in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, there are plans to build military bases, brand new military bases in Iraq, at least 10. I've heard 14. We are going to construct the largest U.S. embassy in Baghdad. That's in the plans. So that flies in the face of all this talk about handing over Iraq to the Iraqi people.
I wonder if I can. Jack, let's bring Eric Blickenstaff in here. He's been traveling, was in Japan at a sort of international peace rally and protest there. Am I right, Eric?
Yes.
What are you hearing from that part of the world about the sort of thing that Jack is talking about? I mean, we can add in here that it's not about peace and democracy, but it's about oil or it's about a permanent presence in the Middle East. How big a part of the opposition that you're aware of are those charges?
I think we're right. It's definitely about something else, and we could spend several other shows about that. But I agree with the last caller. The Iraq leaders that I talked to of this union and women's group, they see that the administration is supporting Islamic extremists in really peaceful movements, and the administration is actually contributing to the blurry lines between who is peaceful, who is violent. And it just angers me to see it, and how that comes out is our soldiers who have goodwill. And this contributes to the violence, contributes to the need for us to be there. Like another caller mentioned, the abuser now having to be there to fix it. And this is just so wrong.
Do you see it changing? Do you see, in fact, any kind of sentiment in this country that is saying, yeah, you're probably right, this is a bad idea, we should leave?
I don't really see it. I'm glad to hear the poll that says more Americans feel it. I just wish more Americans would get out and say that, write letters to the politicians, do things that really have an effect. And I think in another year we'll be a lot closer there. It's just sad to see the physical and psychological effect that will have on both sides between now and then.
Let's hear from Burlington, Vermont. Randy's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Randy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I would like to say that it's amazing that you have all the people that you have on the show today, because it really bumps the discussion up quite a bit. My son is actually in Iraq, and my father was in Vietnam twice, and this is the first time in 30 years that our entire family is on the same side politically. My son is in the National Guard, and he didn't go in the National Guard considering that he would go to Iraq, and he's very much opposed to being there, and from what the things that he tells me are quite horrific. I mean, he's in a transportation company that basically drives back and forth, kind of waiting to be blown up.
Your father's still with us, is he?
My father, yes. My father, in fact, my sister just is working on a documentary showing how the father who went to Vietnam now has a grandson in Iraq, and the father, me, who grew up watching my father go to Vietnam, now has a son in Iraq. And, you know, this is beyond bizarre, because it's amazingly the same situation. And I can't believe that people don't see it, and that we just can't go into other countries and expect them to have a democracy that how we envision it, not how they envision it.
You know, I was thinking, Randy, as I was going through the notes and anticipating my conversation with Jim and with Seth and with Eric, that not to make some kind of parallel with Vietnam, that we are, Jim, at a stage right now where we're dealing with the ups and the downs and the length of time of a conflict that is, in fact, closer to Vietnam, if only for the way that it marks this generation and this time in the country. The people will look back 20, 30, 50 years from now and say, you remember Iraq? I was here. You were there. I thought this. You thought that.
I think that's true. The way in which it's different as far as how it's affecting this country is that the draft was democratic, and it was meant to be democratic, and a majority of this population all over the country was experiencing what it meant to either go to Vietnam or have your loved one go to Vietnam, whereas in the Iraq situation, this is a professional army, and everyone who is there has made that choice, and they tend to be from certain communities like Fort Riley, Kansas, is in the middle of nowhere, and so it's not necessarily that the community is feeling it in the same way. It is... it strikes up people's passions, but I think one of the reasons why you don't necessarily see the street protests and the huge movement is because not a lot of people have that personal stake in it like Eric does, and I understand why he would have that response, and I'm sure the people in his group all have loved ones, and that's kind of a uniting factor. But I'm not sure that this will define America this time, because it seems to me for the majority of the situation, not necessarily on this show, it's an intellectual parlor game, as you said, and not necessarily these are our boys, these are our girls, these are our brothers and sisters over there.
Which I gather from you is not something that you think is necessarily a good thing, that we're only talking about one particular chunk of the population that's directly engaged, right?
I mean, I remember my godmother came out to visit me in Fort Riley, and there's a memorial service for the 40 soldiers who have been killed in Iraq. And she said to me, I haven't known anyone who's been killed in Iraq. And now I'm surrounded by 100 mothers and fathers and wives who lost somebody. And I could just see how it absolutely changed her whole perspective on this environment. And that's why I think this show is worthwhile, because people have to see that this is not just a statistic. It's not just a, you know, like a background as if it's a screensaver on CNN, but it's something that is kind of affecting people's families very deeply, and that people are responding to it in different ways.
Seth, I wonder if you could ever have imagined in the graduating class of 2001 at Harvard that you would be in Najaf and that Jim would be here in the studio and this would be the subject of our conversation.
No, I certainly didn't. And I think that you're right. This has become a new challenge and in many ways also an opportunity for our generation. And I think that how we handle this whole war on terror will help define us. And, of course, it's not just how we fight it overseas, how we succeed in Iraq, but in the long term, how we build international coalitions and work with foreign nations to decrease worldwide terror and build a stronger international community.
Eric, a final thought from you.
I think in the next year we'll find more people join the military family speak out, the Iraq Veterans Against the War. We'll see more soldiers go to jail rather than go back to Iraq. To me, Iraq is not a war on terror. It is an occupation. We have created more terrorists being there, and that is totally the administration's responsibility.
Time, though, for just a final word from Jim and to Seth, to you. Stay safe over there. We appreciate your being with us again. You can say hello as well.
Hey, Seth, take care of yourself over there, and we'll see you for New Year's 2006.
All right. Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And you take care of yourself when you go back, too.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you very much.
Second Lieutenant Jim Meeks, due to deploy back to Iraq next month. Seth Moulton joining us there from Najaf, where he is training Iraqi troops. Eric Blickenstaff, his brother Joseph, was killed in Iraq just over a year ago. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenelosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.